All right, well, after a few weeks off, we're coming back to our study of the Psalms. We began Psalm 2 the last time we were in the book. Now, just to sort of recover that ground a little bit by way of review, then we'll get into the new part. The first two Psalms go together, and they actually form a two-part introduction to the whole of the Psalter, and they have to be read together. Now, Psalm 1 is what we call a Torah psalm, which celebrates the law. There are at least a couple of others. One is Psalm 19, at least the beginning, and then Psalm 119 as a whole. All right, so it's a Torah psalm. Now, Psalm 2 that we come to today is a royal psalm because it speaks of the king. And there are others such as Psalm 73 and 110. Now, in particular, it speaks of the enthronement of the new king of Israel. And so the old king is on the way out, and now he appoints his son to be his successor. Now, we're told in verse 7 that the new king is begotten. Now, that is the metaphor. It's not referring to the actual birthday, but rather when he becomes king. Now, I understand that the queen has at least two birthdays. Is that right? The actual one, and then the time of the coronation, something like that? Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, well, that pretty much follows the pattern then of the kings of Israel. And so what counted really in that setting in the ancient Near East was not so much the actual birthday, but the day that the king assumes the reins of power. That is his begetting in the metaphorical sense. Now, there is no historical situation specified, but we know from Acts 4:25 that David is the author of the second psalm. He's probably speaking to Solomon. And that makes sense because the kingdom was extended to its furthest reign during Solomon's time. And so in that sense, Solomon did receive the nations as his inheritance. And of course, that's all pointing forward to the fact that it's Christ who, in the end, who quite literally then has the nations as his inheritance. Now, the setting of the psalm changes in several ways. There really is just sort of an ABA kind of thing. It starts on earth, and it switches to heaven, and finally it comes back to earth again. And so it's comprising, as it were, the whole of the created order. Now, we pointed out that the psalm is well-crafted. It has four stanzas, just to run through it quickly. We'll be coming to these in turn. But the first relates the plan of the nations to rebel against the Lord and his anointed king. The second is the response of God to their foolish plan. The third is the king's right to occupy the throne in spite of opposition. And the fourth is the psalmist's counsel to the nations. Now, in terms of the historical background, all of this reflects the ancient Near Eastern setting. When an old king died and a new one took the reins of power, there would be an insurrection on the part of those nations that were subject to that particular crown. And so they would take advantage of the period of transition before the new power was consolidated. And so that certainly reflects the history of what was going on. Now, that's Alan Ross, whom we quoted before, commentary on the Psalms. He says, the Psalm reflects a crisis as its original occasion, a crisis that probably occurred frequently in Israel's history. The coronation of a new king was a particularly vulnerable time, for the surrounding nations would have seen it as an opportunity to raid across the border, capture cities, and in general, try to end the Israelite control over them. Accordingly, one of the first tasks of the new king would have been to solidify the borders by defeating the enemies. All right, so that all just reflects real life and what was going on at that period of time. Now, the theology of the psalm represents the Lord as being the sovereign king of the universe. He's the one who rules from heaven. Now, he's far above all opposition. You can compare that with the passage like Isaiah 40, where indeed he controls the nations. And in Deuteronomy 32, he establishes borders. In the book of Daniel chapter 2, he sets up and removes kings. And he is the one then who has put his king on his throne. And so that's what you see makes the whole situation laughable as we come on, that you have these puny kings of the nations. For the moment, they have power. They seem to have solidified all of their rule and authority and sovereignty, but it's nothing because the one who sits in the heavens simply laughs at them. And again, Ross says, no matter how well planned or powerful the opposition was, it was doomed to fail if God was against it. And that is precisely the case. Well, so you can say then that the theme of the psalm is that the king will rule in spite of all opposition to the contrary. And there is plenty of opposition. In fact, ironically, so much of the opposition came from those who should have received Christ as their king. It's there in the prologue of John's Gospel. Now, we're told that the true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the Word was made through him, yet the world knew him not. He came to his own home, referring to Israel, and his own people received him not. Now, they should have been the first to receive him, but they were actually the first to reject him. That's where in John's Gospel as a whole, then, you have that theme of the Gentiles who come to Christ. There were those pilgrims who came to the festival and they wanted to see Jesus. And they represent sort of the vanguard of the new humanity of the nations coming to Christ. And ultimately, of course, his reign is to be universal. Then John goes on to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the power to become the children of God, who were born not of, literally it says bloods, it's referring to bloodlines, nor the will of the flesh, which has to do with the desire of a man to father children, or the will of human beings, but of God. And so the human factor then is bypassed altogether. And that's what the second psalm is anticipating. Indeed, just that. That there's going to be opposition, and yet God is the one who, in spite of whatever man proposes, is the one who disposes. A.W. Pink always used to quote that line, man proposes, but God disposes. And that's precisely right. Now, when it comes to the application of the psalm, this is just the last bit of introduction. Because a royal psalm would have applied to every Davidic king, then ultimately it applies to David's greatest son, which is Christ. And we'll see this later, but to anticipate just a bit. See, that fulfillment, and in Scripture, everything always is fulfilled in phases. It doesn't just come all at one time in one fell swoop. Now, when you read the prophets in particular, that seems to be the case. That there's one coming of Messiah, the establishment of the reign, and that's the end of the story. But then you come to the New Testament, and you find out that there are at least two phases of that fulfillment. Well, we've called so many times the already and the not yet. And so the fulfillment takes place in phases, again we'll say more later, but at the baptism of Christ. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And that's obviously Psalm 2, but it's also Isaiah 42. The two are sort of merged together. So there's the baptism, then there's the transfiguration. And so they go to the Mount of Transfiguration. Of course, Christ is transformed before them. He becomes glorious. They receive some sort of down payment on what his ultimate glory is to be like. And it's likened to the shining of a light. And of course, Peter wants to build tabernacles, you know, so that Moses, Elijah, and Christ would have equal places in this coming kingdom. But then what does the voice from heaven say?
Listen to
exactly so, listen to Christ. And so Moses represents the law and the law and Elijah the prophets, and they had their place, they had their function, but now that the fulfillment has come, they take a back seat to him. And that was a lesson that many Jews had a hard time learning, even the Christian Jews. Because it seemed to them that the law was eternal, everlasting in its Mosaic form. And when you read the Old Testament, you sort of get intimations of that. But when you come to the New, you find out that no, it was intended to fulfill a certain function in history, and then it falls away. And so that's the lesson they had to learn at the Transfiguration. Now, it's not until the resurrection, and that's the next point here, you have Christ's resurrection and exaltation, and it's not until that time, when the Spirit comes at Pentecost, then they can see clearly what was meant to be all along. And we, from our vantage point, might look at them and say, well, they were pretty slow. They seemed to be stupid so much of the time. But in point of fact, if we had been living back there before the coming of the Spirit on Pentecost, then we would have drawn pretty much the same conclusions, would we not? And so we have to have some measure of understanding. And then finally, he comes to establish the kingdom on earth and what we call the parousia, the second coming. And so the second psalm anticipates the eternal reign of Christ. All right, all that just by way of introduction, rather maybe a long-winded introduction, but I think it was necessary. The first three verses, then, are what I call the useless conspiracy of the nations. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us. All right, well, as we said, the setting now is earth, where everything begins. You have the domain of the rulers. And so the psalm begins on that note of puzzlement. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? And so from that point of view, the puzzlement is justified because it's so obvious to the psalmist that the Lord's anointed is going to take charge of the nations. And so why is there this rebellion? Well, it refers to the nations, okay. And back in those days, you would have groups like the Arameans, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites. Now, what about those two in particular? The Moabites and the Edomites. How do they come across in the Old Testament? The friends of Israel, the good guys?
No, the opposite.
Yeah, quite the opposite. They were the enemies.
When Christ was tempted by Satan in the wilderness, and Satan says to him, I will give you all these. Now, if you'll fall down and worship me.
Right.
They were his actually to give.
Oh, yes.
Because Satan actually controls the nations of the world.
That's right, he does.
People, of course, don't realize or admit that. But that's what it says right here in the Psalms. All those nations are rebelling because they're controlled by Satan.
Yeah, exactly so. Right, and they're still doing it for the same reason. That's right. Well, the Moabites and the Edomites in particular were those enemies of Israel. They tried to block, you remember, the Israelites from entering the Promised Land. And so they were forbidden from the assembly of Israel. Now, there were exceptions. Ruth the Moabite, of course, you know, so forth in the days of the judges. But you had them, you had the Phoenicians, you had the Philistines, and they were all perennial enemies of Israel. And so when a new king came to the throne, they would take that as being the most natural time to strike. You know, before everything is consolidated. But the psalmist certainly implies anyway that the rule of this king is for their benefit. Problem is they're unwilling to come under that rule. And the impression is left that the nations hold the advantage just because of sheer numbers. Israel was a small nation. Relatively speaking, the population was quite thin. And so from their vantage point, well, this is a piece of cake, you know. In this time of transition, before everything becomes normal again, we can strike and we can win. But then that's why the psalmist depicts all this as being the vanity of the nations. Now note that the opponents are described in the plural. Is the kings of the earth and the various officials, that both groups and the plural stand over against the Lord and his anointed. But then on the other hand, the Lord and his anointed are both in the singular. And so if the number were to be determined by sheer numbers, well, the opposition would have the upper hand. The opposition would certainly win. But at the end of the day, it's not numbers that count, but rather it's the strength of the Lord, as that strength is exercised through his king who is now coming to the throne. Now, according to Psalms, according to David, what the nations are doing is a couple of things, conspiring or plotting in vain. Conspiring or plotting in vain. One translation is that they are scheming to no purpose. And so they exercise all of their wit, all of their intelligence, all of their knowledge of various sorts, and they think now that they have the upper hand. All they have to do is act at the appropriate time. But the psalmist says that it's all for no purpose. All their schemes are going to come to nothing in the end. Now, it's interesting that the verb translated plot here in Psalm 2 is the very same one that's translated meditate in Psalm 1. See, it's the godly who meditate on the law of the Lord. Now, we're told that that's a word which at heart means to mutter or to murmur. And so as you're meditating on the law, you're sort of mulling it over, you're thinking it to yourself. And in the ancient world, no one read silently. We do. But back then, they all read aloud. And so as they were reading the Torah, then they were contemplating the meaning of the Torah. That's what the godly do. But the wicked, they also have engaged in a kind of, quote, meditation. But it's that of an evil meditation. And of course, there you have that deliberate contrast. The godly meditate on the law of the Lord while the wicked plot against the Lord and his anointed. And so there you have thought processes that are at work. Human beings think. And on the one hand, they think godly thoughts. On the other hand, they think ungodly thoughts. And the ungodly thoughts at the end of the day are all directed to the overthrow of the sovereign of the creation and his anointed one. And you find that in every sort of political movement, basically. In every kind of warlike situation. That we want to be the conquerors. And it's as old as the hills itself. It's as old as the creation. And so the history of mankind is essentially the history of warfare. And so it's not surprising that a Hitler arises. Not surprising that all the ones since Hitler have arisen, because they want to be as God. It all goes back to the Garden of Eden. That we don't want to take orders from anyone, but rather we want to be the ones who give the orders. We want to be God. Now we're told by the psalmist that these nations or these peoples are specifically the kings of the earth and the rulers. They're the ones instigating revolt. And so the enemies of the king are themselves kings. And these kings muster all their resources to overthrow the Lord's anointed. Now, as these nations are led by the rulers, they speak, and underscoring that, they speak with one voice. Let us burst their bonds asunder and let us cast their cords from us. Well, again, that's the language of casting off of the yoke of the Israelite king. We will not have this man rule over us. Remember the parable from the Gospels. And so, in effect, they're saying, we've had enough and we intend to go in our own direction. And again, remember that Israel was never a great world power, that his king would have been despised. And so big talk on the part of the adversaries. But all this talking is in vain at the end of the day. See, the entire rebellion of the nations is depicted as nothing but speech. And talk is cheap. Except when it comes to paying the phone bill, perhaps. But otherwise, talk is cheap. Anyone can talk. It's not the talking, it's the doing. And the only thing they can do is raise their voices, and they have no real power against Israel's king. And so at the end of the day, they will always be frustrated. And the Lord will have them in derision, as the psalmist says. Now the psalmist asks that question, why? Why is all this taking place? Especially when it's for the good of the nations to submit to David's son, to the king. Now, it's what we call a rhetorical question. And what is a rhetorical question?
Basically a statement in the form of a question.
That's right, exactly so. It's not really asking for information because the answer is already understood. So it's rhetorical. The implied answer is that they will not have this man rule over them. Who is he? Who is he to tell us what to do? We're as good as he is. We have our own way of doing things. And yet the psalmist effectively replies to that and says, well, your way of doing things is all wrong. That it needs to come out of the dominion of the one who really is the king. The one who really does possess power and authority and sovereignty. All right, so the psalm begins in that way. Now, the second part of it, verses 4 through 6, you have God's response. And again, he who sits in the heaven shall laugh. The Lord will have them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. All right, now here the scene shifts to heaven, where the Lord is enthroned, of course. He's far above the nations. He is in no way alarmed by their rebellion, because the nations are like grasshoppers. And so the psalmist here defers to the one who really is the sovereign of the universe. Now, to say that he sits in the heaven is to say that heaven is his throne room. Remember in Hebrews 1 that Christ sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high? So there he assumes control of the universe as God's right hand, and so it is that he shares the rule with God. And so that's what the Israelite king is doing as well. This is representative on earth. And then when we shift forward to the Christological significance of that, here is Christ, then, who takes control of the nations. So he's in heaven. He's far above anything that human beings can do. And not only is he seated there, but rather he laughs and he mocks at the kings of the earth. Yeah, that's it.
Nowadays, man has decided that he even is the one who decided how the universe began.
Oh, yes.
You know, he's
exactly so.
He's the authority on what happens. You know.
Oh, of course.
You can't believe this book which tells you what happened a few thousand years ago. You
yeah.
can't believe me who tells you what happened 16 billion years ago.
Yeah, well, precisely so.
That's right. The ultimate arrogance.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is, exactly what it is. Yeah, and that's what the psalmist is deriving then, is the arrogance of human beings who are we'll cite it in a moment from Isaiah, but like the grasshoppers. All right, so God laughs, and laughter is in mockery, there are signs of contempt. Now, we laugh at those who can not possibly do us any harm. What can they do? The answer is nothing. And to reflect on Isaiah 40, it says, have you not known and have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spread them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. And again, that's the history of mankind, that they arise for a while. So you have the Hittites, for example, a mighty empire, the Babylonians, the Romans, the Mongolian Empire, and it's all the same story. They had their day, and then they go the way of the dodo. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth, when he blows upon them, and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. High poetry, but it's also very realistic in terms of what happens. And so today's kingdoms, today's empires, if the world lasts long enough, one of these days they're going to be history as well. And what's going to arise thereafter, well, we don't know. But we do know that it's all temporal in the end. And so all flesh is as grass, as Isaiah also calls out. And so we have to see ourselves in that light. And it's only when we see ourselves in that light as being mere grass that we understand who the real sovereign of the universe is, and it's to him that we give our allegiance and our service. And he's the one then who's going to reward us as his servants in the end. And so those of us who are willing to humble ourselves under his reign then are going to be exalted by him in the end. And that's the great promise, not just in the psalm, but really of so much of Scripture generally. Well, is there anything else we can take up by way of question? Okay. Thank you.